This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome back to The Bunker, your daily dose of news and politics. I'm Andrew Harrison. And thanks to everybody who's been helping to keep us going by backing us on Patreon. We've had a lot of new supporters signing up lately, and if you'd like to join them, then search Bunker Podcast Patreon or follow the link in the show notes. Today, political rivalries. Successful political careers can be driven by many things. Conviction, idealism, the sense of a calling, egotism, narcissism, even straight-up careerism. But one of the most powerful fuels is a simple desire to put one over on somebody you really, really hate. Pure bloody-mindedness can get you out of bed in the morning. And from Thatcher versus Hasseltine and Blair versus Brown, all the way back to Lloyd George versus Asquith, the true political titan seems to call their own nemesis into being. Why does politics so often fall into this pattern? What can we learn from it? And is a truly rancorous political rivalry not just entertaining, but a good thing for politics too? Seth Tavo knows all about rivalry. He is the author of Behind Closed Doors, The Secret Life of London's Private Members Clubs, where many an eminent back has been stabbed. Hello, Seth. How are you?
Hello. Well, thanks. And you?
I'm not bad. So you and I chatted before we started recording, and the examples of infamous political rivalries were so notorious and numerous, they just jumped into the mind immediately. Thatcher and Hasseltine. But also Thatcher and Heath, Blair and Brown, obviously, Disraeli and Gladstone. And then you pulled out something I really wasn't expecting. I didn't know that Churchill's real visceral loathing was for Nye Bevan. Is true rivalry a benefit to politics, do you think?
I think it helps that people bounce off ideas competitively against each other. I mean, that's actually what politics is about. It's resorting war through peaceful means. It depends entirely on how personal it gets. When the personal overrides the principle, then you've got a problem.
Do you think people govern or maybe campaign better when they do have an arch enemy to focus upon, though?
It might help people get up in the mornings. But again, does it make them have better judgment? Not necessarily. You know, it's your weak spot if you're thinking, I'm going to bring down that person rather than I'm here for a cause.
Yeah. What's the most unwise thing or the worst thing a politician has done just to spite a rival that you can that springs to mind?
I mean, I think most of Gordon Brown's leadership was really bad. You know, a sort of 13-year spat fitting into that category. But what that does illustrate, actually, is this problem of how you treat your rival, whether you work with them or whether you ostracize them completely. And neither of those works terribly well. A particularly notorious one was Harold Wilson, who tried to work with George Brown. Brilliant, talented man, George Brown, who was his deputy de facto and was first Secretary of State. But he was an alcoholic and he basically was just useless after, you know, 11 in the morning. Yeah. And so the unwise thing of promoting somebody who's clearly not up to it, but you're trying to keep these sort of disputes together, that really undermines leadership.
Okay, well, let's talk about some individual examples. First up, a very infamous one, Thatcher and Heath. He really hated her and she made it worse by treating him almost as beneath her notice. The Guardian described it as one of the most sulphurous feuds in modern British politics. What was the core of the hatred, Seth?
I think it was actually about very different politics. Heath embraced One Nation conservatism, corporatism, a sort of conciliatory approach to trade unions, the idea that the Conservatives would be a very much uniting force. Thatcher was a divider. I mean, she saw that as her great strength, that she knew what she was going to do and she was going to go out and get it. And she saw him as a failure. In his case, I think there was also an element of misogyny. Tinges more than a few of his remarks to her over the years. You know, he didn't take her seriously. There are stories about how he nearly sacked her more than one occasion. But was told, no, she's the only woman in the cabinet and we haven't got anyone else lined up. So just by default, she's there. What's weird is how they were so alike, though.
Yeah, because they're both sort of lower middle class, the kind of people that the actual true Tory knobs would themselves look down upon.
Yeah, I mean, they both were sort of grammar school kids who went to Oxford, yeah. Did incredibly well there, was seen as part of the new generation. Remember, before Ted Heath, the previous Tory leader had been the 13th Earl of Hume. They go from the aristocrat's aristocrat after, you know, a succession of very aristocratic prime ministers, after Eden, after Churchill, to suddenly they've got this lower middle class grammar school boy who's, yes, sort of forcing his H's all the time and is being mocked for how he speaks by the Tory shires. And Thatcher sort of disdains him a little bit for that as well, because I think both of them sees the other as a traitor to their class. They both lived in quite high style by the time they were in politics. They both lived in Mayfair and Belgravia, yeah, when they were in politics. They both have pretty substantial incomes from pretty substantial overseas business interests when they're in their retirement. And each of them, I think, looked on the other as being slightly venal and having sold out.
She had criticised his prime ministership. They were split over Europe, weren't they? Yep. And that kind of division was described on Heath's part as the longest sulk in history. This actually goes right. This is almost the original sin of the Tory party that's still crucifying them to, yep, this day.
And remember that Ted Heath is someone who actually attended, as an observer, a Nuremberg rally. He talks about how his hand brushed Adolf Hitler going past. And he was deeply scarred by that, deeply anti-Nazi, somebody who, you know, had served with distinction in the war.
Yeah.
And his strong view was Europe needed to unite to stop that from ever happening again. And that was the one thing he was going to do as prime minister, drag Britain kicking and screaming. And Thatcher moved from being totally signed up to that during his time in his, yeah, government. You know, those famous pictures of her in a European jumper.
That lovely jumper.
But by the end of her premiership, for sure, she'd completely moved into a very different position. So, yeah, that they really divided. I mean, when Thatcher was ousted, Heath was asked by a journalist, "Is it true that you said on her resignation, rejoice, rejoice?" He said, "No, no, no, not a word of it. Absolutely, completely defamatory and outrageous. How dare you?" "I said it three times, I think. Oof. Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice."
The pettiness was incredible. He wrote to The Sun in 1985 saying that she had never offered him any ministerial post except ambassador to the United States, which would have got him out of Parliament. "I offer, yes, you the ambassadorship to what's the furthest country I can think of?"
There is actually precedent for that. Winston Churchill offered the Earl of Halifax, his leadership rival in 1940, ambassadorship to the United States, and it did get rid of him and basically took him out of consideration. Clearly, Heath was thinking of that. But, you know, it's not a bad job to be offered. I think what he was comparing it, though, is that he had actually been quite generous to his predecessor. So Lord Hume, previously being Prime Minister, had actually been Foreign Secretary, and Ted Heath makes him Foreign Secretary in his government. Mm-hmm. And I think Heath did feel he was owed something of that sort of calibre, and was rather disappointed that Thatcher didn't want to have anything to do with him.
Thatcher sort of buried the hatchet at a dinner in 1999, when she was giving a speech to celebrate 20 years of her election, and she described him as one of Britain's most forceful and effective prime ministers. Go back and read his 1970 manifesto. It's one of the boldest and best the Conservative Party ever produced. Well, that was one phase of the Conservatives which Heath rapidly resiled from. I suppose the other side of it is that it's very easy to be magnanimous when you've won, and actually that form of magnanimity is kind of grinding the boot in a little, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think there are limits to how magnanimous they were. I mean, I just remember the body language around that time. They had a Conservative Party conference where on the stage you had a bunch of sofas behind the speaker, and they had as decorations Margaret Thatcher and Ted Heath just sat on the sofas, and they looked so uncomfortable, and they were sort of looking, staring at their watches, hoping to get out of there.
God, well, Thatcher, being such an astonishing figure, had not one but at least two arch enemies, and another was Heseltine. Mm-hmm. In many respects, politically, a bit of a more formidable foe. Heseltine first stormed out of cabinet during what became known as the Westland Affair, an argument about a helicopter firm in 1986, and then later he stood against her for the leadership in 1990, effectively precipitating the sequence of events which ended her leadership. Have they always been kind of at daggers drawn?
I think so. I mean, Heseltine went back to the Heath government as a junior minister, and she always mistrusted him as a Heathite. She always thought, he's not one of us. She did give him a job, which I think she probably thought was a non-job, making him Secretary of State for the Environment. You know, she considered it was quite a small post. Yeah. And I think it surprised her, with things like the regeneration of Liverpool, how high, yeah, profile he made that job. And indeed, she rewarded him by moving him to defence again, I think because she wanted to get rid of him and move in something less high profile.
The standing joke at the time was that it was basically two people with the same hairstyle fighting over whatever comb would enable them to maintain it. Heseltine, fair bit posher than Thatcher, yes?
Ish. I mean, he's, again, from a Welsh grammar school background. Mm. I think he more took to Oxford in a way that she didn't. She was very much confrontational. Also, remember, it was a gender-segregated university when they attended it. So yeah. The women's colleges were very much a separate thing from the sort of male core of Oxford at the time. And I think he was sort of this much more clubbable sort of MP who was much more familiar with other Tory MPs. She was never wholly comfortable with the rank and file of the Tory party.
It's usually imagined these days that Thatcher sort of hit the ground stampeding and was immediately all-powerful on an election in 1979. But that's not true at all, is it? She was very, very compromised on the back foot in the early part of her first term.
She ground down her opponents one by one and picked them off in her cabinet. And you see that, for example, the picking off of the Wets in her cabinet. Yeah. So that the Thatcher of 1989 is very different from the Thatcher of 1980 when people are saying, oh, she's not long for this world. You know, we're going to oust her very quickly, I'm sure.
Heseltine was never forgiven for bringing her down by the true believers in the Tory party, and you kept hearing this sort of quasi-Shakespearean line about the one who wields the knife never wearing the crown. Did the rivalry do for him as much as it did for her?
Not as much. I mean, you've got to remember that actually John Major saves him from political obscurity. John Major doesn't trust Michael Heseltine originally. He makes him Secretary of State for the Environment. He gives him his old job back, overseeing the poll tax, a poison chalice if ever there was one.
But he gets to do something he must have absolutely relished, which is kill a policy she had staked her career on and lost.
But Heseltine actually makes a real success of it. And by the end of Major's premiership, he says he trusts Heseltine more than anyone else. He makes him Deputy Prime Minister for his last couple of years. And he really does feel that, you know, he has a sort of latter-day renaissance as a potential Tory leader. I mean, obviously, his health means he doesn't go for it in the end. Yeah. But no, Heseltine was still sticking around when Thatcher... In fact, still, Heseltine still is around.
Yes, he is. And we've had him on the podcast. You know, that's how around he is. While we're still on Tories then... David Cameron and Boris Johnson. Now, this is a different kind of rivalry because it's less expressed purely in the realm of cabinet. It actually kind of goes back to Eton, doesn't it?
It sort of does. I actually think that it really took off in a big way at Oxford.
Right.
Because they were much more sort of active in overlapping circles of friends. Johnson was the one who was, you know, going out there to try and be president of the union at all costs, standing on an SDP slate the second time round. He originally stood for the Conservatives and lost. So he stood the second time round and assured everyone he had very moderate politics and had changed completely. Cameron, very presciently, was just busy chillaxing and not doing very much.
People don't change, do they, in any way at all? I was nosing around on this one and found, this is an ancient press cutting, that Cameron was described, and I'm going to pronounce this wrongly because of my poor education, Seth. Cameron was described as an oppidan, is that right?
I have no idea.
Well, anyway, this was kind of what they referred to, people who are more posh than smart, as in you're in Eton because of your connections and money, while Johnson was the swat. Johnson was the toil of the hard worker. Yeah. I would have thought it'd be exactly the other way around.
You have to remember that Boris Johnson was a scholarship boy at Eton. When Stanley Johnson has spoken about this, he said, oh, no, my boys, it's a matter of pride that we all, Johnsons, just are the cleverest, and money would never have been a consideration. We were just going to go after the scholarship anyway. I'm not sure that's entirely true. If you look at how precarious Stanley Johnson's whole sort of home setup was at the time, Johnson wasn't that well off. But then something that Cameron and Johnson have in common is neither is anywhere near as posh as they often pretend to be. You know, Cameron, yes, he's descended from previous monarchs, but that's via bastard children of George III. Yes, he's an old Etonian, but, you know, even within Etonians, people will sniff that he's only a second generation old Etonian. You know, there are people who are sort of 15 generation old Etonians out there. So Cameron is not considered that posh by his peers. And Boris Johnson, likewise, he had that sort of taint of, oh, he'll, you know, he's the scholarship boy who's here as a charity case. Both of them, I think, to anyone amongst the 99.999% of the population not at Eton, of course, come across that way.
Back to their rivalry. You know, again, with distance, the insanity of it becomes clearer. The idea that this kind of moderately warm rivalry carried on from Oxford into the Conservative Party becomes white hot in Brexit, where both Cameron and Johnson gamble the future of the country on their own personal rivalry. Cameron thinks he can't lose this referendum, and Johnson sees it as, what's the Game of Thrones line? Chaos is a ladder, the ladder he can climb, and he climbs it and he gets to the top and destroys Cameron. And the only price he pays is the ruin of the whole country.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
I mean, obviously Cameron retires to this ridiculous caravan that he buys, but Do we know how the relationship, such as it is, has been since?
Well, I'd actually say more than just the caravan, because both of them have quite ostentatious taste. You know, Cameron bought this £3 million pile in Cornwall and then fitted up a £1 million man cave, as he calls it, up with a sort of giant games room. And, you know, and assured people that he was terribly, terribly concerned on these issues around autism and disability in many charities that he was presiding over, which he promptly drops within less than 24 hours on being offered another job in government, you know. And I mention this because this is actually not such a dissimilar thing to what I think Boris Johnson could well do, you know. Firstly, he's clearly out there looking to make as much money as possible. And because he's no longer an MP, we don't know how much money he's making. You know, he was certainly on track to be making at least £3 million a year just from speaker's fees alone, and may well be making significantly more than that. But he's clearly interested in maintaining a public profile and possibly even having another tilt at office.
One aspect of the Etonian mindset that even a pleb like me knows is that you're supposed to approach life as if nothing matters. You can put everything on a game of pitch and toss and walk away and be a man, my son, etc. Is there still rancour there? Because of the way that Cameron sort of has been re-recruited to this wreck of a government left behind by Johnson and Truss, do they take the approach that, well, nothing really matters?
I think when you are used to dealing with the super rich being all around you, who are used to gambling everything on one stake and on one play of the hand in cards, the idea that you play high-stakes gambling with the entire country seems second nature.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Let's move on to Blair and Brown, who worked together for 2.5 terms, actually before that as well, obviously. Mm. Blair would publicly praise him as our Iron Chancellor and privately believe Brown had psychological flaws. Is it, you know, simply the, again, a personality clash, but obviously they had different politics as well?
I think there's truth in both of those. It's easy to forget that Gordon Brown, before and after his time in office, I think was a much more charismatic figure. You know, we've seen him since he stopped being prime minister, rediscovering his sense of humour and being a much more self-assured person. And people forget that actually the Gordon Brown of the 1990s was a laughy, jokey, ironic person who was very self-assured. His problem, and this is why, you know, Blair may have a point in suggesting there are psychological flaws, he would lock himself away. He became, you know, really quite bitter a lot of the time, would surround himself with these people like Damien McBride who would sort of feed him almost this sort of Nixon-style politics of smear. Blair, on the other hand, I mean, he kept himself refreshed because, you know, the phrase from 1970s politicians was that he would make love to the people, you know, and he would really sort of take this messianic air. And there is a psychological flaw as well. I mean, which of the two is actually less flawed? I couldn't say, because they're two very different problems.
Yeah, Brown was often presented as this kind of Caliban figure, because he's raging against the kind of sort of gilded guy that is always in the sun and can never do any wrong. Even when he does wrong, somehow he's forgiven. And yet here's me, Gordon, in the mines, doing all the work and getting all of the credit. I mean, do we know what they really thought of each other? They had regular stand-up rows. Brown kept Blair in the dark over many sensitive issues, you know, even things like the budget, let alone whether Britain would join the euro or not. Blair had to stop Brown from sacking the governor of the Bank of England, Eddie George. There was a point at which Brown shouted, "You've stolen my fucking budget," at him. I mean, beneath this kind of headbutting, was there actual respect or was it just pure hatred?
I think there was certainly respect, but like any relationship, it's changed over time. Mm. And certainly in the 1990s, at the earlier stage, and you're looking at the sort of mythology of the Granitar deal, and we don't know how true some of these accounts are, but the suggestion was one and you're done, that Blair would do just one term and hand over to Gordon Brown. I'm sceptical about that because I find it rather hard to believe either that Blair would offer that or that Brown would accept that. But certainly when you're getting into a question of two and you're done, you know, that Blair does two full terms in office, and that's actually quite a reasonable thing to say to anyone, you know, this amazing hypothetical that you'll manage to win two general elections in a row with majorities and then hand over. That might be a reasonable thing to do for any prime minister. So really, things became very, very strained in that sort of third half term, particularly. They basically weren't speaking to each other outside of meetings. And, you know, there are tales of Brown yelling at Blair, "You've ruined my life," which, you know, even if he didn't say it, it's the kind of thing you can imagine him saying. Yeah.
I always found the idea of the deal so incomprehensible. It's like, it's politics. It's not musical chairs. You don't. It's not your go. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like the prime minister stays in position until they either decide to leave or their position is untenable. Mm. Nobody comes in with a stopwatch and goes, "I'm sorry, prime minister. You know, come in number six. Your time is up."
Particularly if it's some sort of secret agreement that no one has any way of knowing even happened.
Yeah. Brown seemed to have almost total autonomy when he was chancellor, which may have exacerbated it. In many ways, he bullied number 10. Andrew Rawnsley's book, which exposed the rivalry, said, "The itch that Brown could not stop himself scratching was the smouldering resentment that Blair had taken first prize in politics." Is it ultimately the psychological thing of second place can never bear first place?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's a matter of how you manage those relationships.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that it was first and second. I think it didn't help that Gordon Brown was effectively running a shadow operation with his own civil servants accountable to him and a sort of very personal style. You know, these were people like a young Ed Balls and Charlie Whelan. And if you look at other previous number twos, the prime ministers, where there's been a rivalry, they didn't do things like that. George Brown didn't undermine Harold Wilson by running his own operation. He didn't try to take government policy around him. You know, Heseltine didn't manage John Major in that way.
Yeah. I mean, of all the rivalries that we're looking at, including some that we'll talk about later, I couldn't see that many of them actually damaged government apart from this one. It seemed it made New Labour weaker. It made government harder. It ultimately contributed to the ending of Blair. And it seemed to drain the powers of Brown such that when he became Prime Minister, and let's not forget, he did save the world in his brief time. Mm. He just seemed to no longer have the energy needed to do it.
I think there's some truth there, but I wouldn't take it too far because there was an exhaustion from just having been in office for 13 years by the end, which was very, very apparent. There was also an exhaustion of talent, which had nothing to do with the Blair-Brown divide. Yeah. It was just that very capable people started doing stuff early on. And, you know, whether they were embroiled in some scandal or other or just decided to retire by a decade later, you weren't getting, you know, the first division team by the time Gordon Brown was there. He had some good people. You know, Alistair Darling was a phenomenally competent chancellor. But a lot of even his cabinet were looking pretty second rate. So I don't think that was necessarily anything to do with the Blair-Brown rift. I think that was just from having been in power for too long.
Yeah, attrition sets in, as you'll be able to see from, I don't know, looking at a newspaper today. Let's move on to Winston Churchill, who, again, another such a big figure that he had two archenemies, not just one, both Neville Chamberlain and Knyghe Bevan. Let's talk about Chamberlain first. Was it just Chamberlain's appeasement of Germany and the pain to Churchill of being marginalised that did it, or was it more than that? Was it more fundamental?
There was a bit of lingering ambition. Remember, Churchill's out of office for 10 years from 1929 to 39, and he bitterly resents that Neville Chamberlain, you know, the younger brother of Austen Chamberlain and the son of Joe Chamberlain, is the golden boy of Tory politics, who, without even an election, effortlessly glides into office. And Chamberlain is actually really bad at managing people. I mean, he's a bit of a bully. He doesn't brook any discussion. And if anybody brings him a proposal that questions his thinking, he denounces them for betraying him. So he's not a particularly good person to have as number one. I mean, there are arguments that he was a good administrator in terms of being a good health minister. But as prime minister, he's terrible.
Yeah, that's kind of what we would now consider the hallmarks of bad leadership. You know, defensiveness, fear of ideas, seeing any interventionist challenge.
Yeah, makes... you know, and Churchill had made a lot of mistakes by that stage, but he's also been around the block. He'd occupied a lot of senior positions in government, and he was, remarkably for somebody in politics, somebody who learned from their mistakes and would write long books saying, "I screwed up on this," and that's a real rarity today.
Quite a lot of people would say he had quite a lot of mistakes to learn from.
Indeed.
With a high body count as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Tell us more about the rivalry, the way they interacted, because obviously Churchill takes the top job after Chamberlain bungles the 1940 campaign in Norway, and probably Britain's, you know, approaching Britain's lowest point in the war. But that's you know, that's the end of the relationship. Tell us about that rivalry.
We often think of Churchill the statesman, and we don't appreciate Churchill the politician. He's very slippery in how he manages that rivalry. He phrases his support for Chamberlain as being absolute, but also makes it very clear that he's not supporting some aspects of government policy. The Norway debate evolves in such a way that Chamberlain ends up taking the rap, even though Churchill is the minister responsible,
wow,
as First Lord of the Admiralty, for sending the naval task force that's a complete cock-up in the first place. And quite notoriously, when the king tries to ask Churchill for advice on who should be his successor, he knows that it's a trap. And Churchill knows that if he says, it should be me, they'll discount that because they'll say, oh, well, you're just trying to promote yourself. And he knows that if he tries to be polite and says Lord Halifax, they'll say, oh, well, I suppose that'll be Lord Halifax will present as the Prime Minister. So he turns his back on the king and never replies. He's really quite canny in how he controls this. And in the months that follow, I mean, helpfully for Churchill, Neville Chamberlain is a very sick man. He actually dies of cancer 6 months after stepping down. But for a while, he's still leader of the Conservative Party while Churchill is Prime Minister. And Churchill manages that relationship. He flatters him shamelessly. He promotes Chamberlain's aides. And he really does make a point of not being seen as too divisive a leader.
Why did Churchill hate Nye Bevan so much? Was it just because he was an uppity poor person?
I think that's a big part of it. I mean, Churchill is obsessed with this sort of glory of aristocratic 19th century Britain and how to save that. We often forget also Churchill was quite radical on most of his domestic views. On the foreign policy front, he was incredibly imperialistic. But on domestic front, the reason why he was so in favour of reform was to try and preserve the old order, to try and preserve the idea of, you know, aristocrats who would preside over all of this. Nye Bevan was a challenge to that. And Nye Bevan was somebody from outside of the political system. He wasn't someone like Clement Attlee or even Ernest Bevin who would, you know, tug their forelock a fair bit and show a bit of respect to the old order. He just didn't care about people like Churchill and thought they were an anachronism.
Presumably it was a mutual loathing.
When Bevin said that the Conservatives were lower than vermin, I think he had Churchill in mind.
Let's wind up with the rapid fire round. Why did Lloyd George and Asquith despise each other?
Asquith is one of my political heroes, so I'm not going to be at all neutral on this. Lloyd George basically would trade away anything. I mean, he offered to defect from the Liberals to the Conservatives to merge with them. He offered to defect from the Liberals to Labour to merge with them. In both cases, so long as he could lead whatever was left. There is no cause advocated by Lloyd George which he did not betray. Asquith had a very definite set of ideas about how he wanted to. I mean, Asquith's style was basically to be unrelentlessly radical in his government, but sound very conservative in the reasons why he was doing these things, like creating the welfare state.
Mm. Shirley Williams and Barbara Castle. Explain them to our under 75 listeners.
I think that was probably a real sort of north-south divide, actually, more than anything else. Shirley Williams, you know, from the sort of middle-class intellectual tradition, you know, Vera Brittain's daughter and very much steeped in this Edwardian world almost 20 years on. Barbara Castle, life and soul, backbone of the Labour Party, didn't have much time for her. The feeling was mutual.
Finally, Gladstone and Disraeli fell out over the Corn Laws. It became incredibly petty. When Gladstone took over Disraeli as Chancellor in 1852, he refused to pay Disraeli's moving bill. And Disraeli took his revenge by keeping the ceremonial gown so that Gladstone couldn't wear it. This is real kind of low-level stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a well-known saying that Disraeli said that if Mr. Gladstone were to fall into the Thames, it would be a misfortune, but if someone were to pull him out again, it would be a calamity.
I mean, people do tend to think that politics is really about ideas and great tides of economics and great tides of movements, and the personality is just fluff. But I think, as you described here, it really isn't. It shapes things as well, particularly you know, the irrational aspect, rivalries, hatreds, loves and passions and so forth.
And it can make for a healthy or an unhealthy political discourse.
Seth, thank you for joining me to talk about rancor, rivalry and spleen. It's always better out than in. Listeners, thanks for listening. Don't forget, the advertising industry, our arch rival, is getting a little bit more parsimonious these days when it comes to podcasts. So we really need your help to keep bringing you The Bunker every day. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast or follow the link in the show notes to find out how you can secure our future into the election year and beyond. I'm Andrew Harrison. This has been The Bunker. We'll see you next time.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison. The audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.